And out of the box this afternoon, we are thrilled to welcome to the program a journalist, anchorman, a documentarian. He's the winner of 2 Peabody Awards, numerous Emmy Awards. You know him from his work on the CBS, the Decades Channel. Or perhaps if you're like me, a weekend listener to Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, you appreciate his work there as well. We are pleased to be joined this afternoon by Bill Curtis.
Hi, Rich. Oh, good to be there.
Well, you have had such a remarkable career, Bill, but in doing a little research, I came to find out that this was not the plan. You were well on your way to a career in law. What happened?
Boy, a big surprise. I had accepted a job at a trial firm in Wichita, Kansas. I was studying for the bar there with the rest of my colleagues. And a friend, the news director at the local TV station, WIVW, asked me to fill in on the 6 o'clock news. So off I went, leaving my tax law review class. I was happy to do that. And delivered a half hour. They said, why don't you stick around? We have some strong weather that's coming across from Manhattan, about 60 miles away. And when I got pretty close to us, I had a cameraman who was out on the southwest edge of the city. We had dispersed all our guys. And he said, well, we've got a tornado on the ground. I see it. It's right in front of me. It's huge. And it's headed for the city. 150,000, capital of Kansas. Between the tornado and, the Capitol Dome, where it was headed, you know, you have a college where the law school was. You have a mental institution. You have shopping malls and residential developments. So it was pretty serious. I waited, kind of held my fire until I confirmed what it was, that it wouldn't dissipate, jump up in the air again. And the next report he had was that the Huntington apartment complex, 200 apartments had been wiped out right down to the ground. What I didn't know is that it was an E5 before they even rated tornadoes.
Wow.
This was 1966. And so I gave the warning. I was 26 years old and stuck with the slot where you knew the words meant life and death. And I said, for God's sake, take cover. My face went as white as my shirt. And we stayed on the air for 24 hours, but couldn't stop the tornado. It went right through town, 11 miles on the ground. I think we had 17 dead and probably more damage. It was the first to hit and may still be, the biggest city to take that big a tornado. Usually they're out on the plains and they get a farmhouse here and there or a trailer park. And it was serious. So I, I said, and I'd been struggling with the decision between staying in broadcasting and, practicing law. And you have to assess your talents. But you go to 3 years in law school and you also want to use that to practice. And I said, well, nope, God is showing me the way. And so I sent out my tape. We did that too in those days. And I was picked up at CBS, made the jump, which is a big jump to a big market. And the rest is history. 30 years with CBS and 50 years in all, my own production company. Incidentally, I went back. My start was in Independence at a little 250-watt station. And when my first boss in 1958, when I was in high school, died, I went back and bought the station. And it was a purchase out of emotion and nostalgia more than anything else. So I know from the inside out the value of a community radio station that really serves the people. And, I was lucky.
Absolutely. Well, you arrived in Chicago at a fortuitous time in American history with the assassination of Martin Luther King and all that followed that, and then the Democratic Convention of 1968.
It was a big one. Today in the Washington Post, there is an article about Kent State and the young girl who was caught on film, you know, with anguish in her face, kneeling over one of the dead students that had been shot by the National Guard. That became the symbol of anti-war protests. And it was just before I frankly left to go with CBS News out on the coast. But those 4 years were really formative. I had the Richard Speck trial, one of the trials of the century. We had King assassinated, Bobby Kennedy assassinated, Chicago burning, major cities across the country burning. And then you had the Democratic Convention with the protests in the street. And then you had the next year, the conspiracy trial, which is now up for an Oscar.
Right.
You know, in Sorkin's depiction of it. And then I covered the conspiracy trial and Manson, Charles Manson, in 70, and Angela Davis to follow, and Juan Corona, who killed 25 people. So those were all trials of the century. And I said, yeah, I know. I've covered four of them.
Now, it was also it was your investigative team that broke the story of Agent Orange as well, wasn't it?
Probably, yes. Probably the biggest story that I'm associated with, mainly because it's still going on. The Vietnamese are still have a, in The Hague, have a lawsuit against us for the damage that, you know, Agent Orange did to the populace. And it was a tough one, and certainly I called on my legal background because I had to get ready to go to trial if necessary. I was a journalist and didn't have the weight of the responsibility of getting enough of the real evidence. But I had got enough, and I had to prove, first of all, I had to prove that I got four names from the Veterans Administration office. And, I'm sorry, 11, and they were, you know, soldiers, and no sailors, some Air Force people, who had come down with symptoms that were unexplained, similar but unexplained, and they were being brushed off by the VA. And so I went and interviewed all of them, and they were, you know, really poignant stories. But they all described seeing a white mist of defoliant that was sprayed on the trees to create these free fire zones around, especially around landing strips for helicopters and places where they needed to clear of, you know, the free fire area, so you could see the enemy coming. Otherwise, they'd sneak right up in the trees and kill you. So there was a reason they used it, but they didn't know how powerful it was. It had been used for 40 years by farmers, okay, as long as you, you know, followed the directions.
Right.
But when war came along, they wanted to increase the amount. They really liked it. And in increasing the amount, it increased the amount of dioxin which is the most poisonous substance we make, man makes. And so we went from first you know, estimations of 10 pounds. Well, we just sprayed 10 pounds of dioxin, you know, in the rest of the mix over Vietnam. Well, it was far more than that. And nobody really knew until we started going through the records after the war. And when it fell, and also nobody realized, and I say nobody, that means the military, realized that we were spraying our own troops as well as the Vietnamese, but as well as the jungle and the foliage. Triple canopy, boy, you know, you have to. But one of the clues that tipped me off was a guy, a grunt, you know, with a Marine rifle squad. He said, yeah, we would walk through the jungle. And we saw the white stuff, and it was hanging on the trees. And what he didn't know is that ordinarily it takes 2 weeks to work through the poison cycle. It's sort of hormonal, so that it causes the vegetation to outgrow itself. And he said, well, we saw it fall, the leaves falling off in 2 hours. Oh, 2 hours instead of 2 weeks. Suddenly, you know, this stuff is different and poisonous. Well, the long and short of it is that, you know, there was a huge, I went back to the Armed Services Committee that was jammed because people had heard the report from this small station. I mean, not small, but it was a local piece for BBM in Chicago, happened to be owned by CBS. And we did a Cronkite piece, but basically we were the ones doing the research, and the VA wanted to kill us, kill it, because, well, what did they know? If it was really important, the network, Cronkite, would have been doing it. But we hung in there, and I go into this gathering, and all the top VA people were there, and they were all set to knock us down. And the camera... And I played an hour documentary that we had done on it. The camera zooms in to this one young soldier with his five-year-old that had come in. And the five-year-old put his hand on his knee. And as we zoom the camera in, it shows the tip of his little finger hanging by skin, a congenital birth defect that... all of a sudden sweeps over this very high-powered audience, and all I could hear was just, oh, my God, realize one picture did it. You know, realize what we have done to our own troops. Well, from there, the VA finally started to recognize problems that we really, you know, you can't have a causal effect for cancer. It just happens, and it's impossible to go back 20 years. Well, roughly the same kind of thing. Today, 200,000 veterans have been compensated. 50 diseases are now recognized as connected, and it's still going on. And what the reason is that, you know, the theory is that it got into the fatty tissue and stayed there until a guy loses weight. When he loses weight, why, the chemical comes out and causes the problem. And now we are seeing 65-year-old guys who are suffering from Agent Orange poisoning. Goes all the way back. And who knows when it'll stop, but it was chemical and biological warfare that, and they finally stopped it. Anyway, that's the biggest one I've been associated with.
We're talking with Bill Curtis here on Downtown. Curtis Productions has done an incredible number of brilliant documentaries, and a large focus of your work, too, has been on conservation. What made that an important cause for you, Bill?
I always wanted to be a forest ranger, but I also, when I started my own company, and this must have been 88, 90, I wanted to prove that we could take, that I could compete with National Geographic, you know, and we could take this, the top, what I saw as the top story of the day. This is in 1990, and it was about climate change. And if you were into the science, they were already saying, well, you know, the world is going to heat up and carbon dioxide is going to increase. And, you know, the whole world will change. We were getting predictions of the Southwest United States entering a mega drought so bad that people, one, couldn't make a living, but they would be migrating out of the United States and finding other places to live because it was so bad. Well, what do we have today? Go to the internet and look up U.S. drought and see what it says. But to me, these stories should have been on the front page then. It took about 20 years before it really sunk in, I guess. But it took me to every problem, the rainforest and deforestation. And, I went 8,000 feet down in the Pacific off the Galapagos to discover new life down there, according to Rich Lutz, a scientist at Rutgers University. And all around, it was the best. We did 100 shows for PBS called The New Explorers, and it was educational, we thought, for about seventh grade. But it was the best thing that I've done, and finally wound up making the transition over to something that paid, which was Cold Case Files and American Justice and Murders. So some substance exchanged for entertainment.
Well, I enjoy the work you do as well on the Decades Channel. Through the Decades is a wonderful look at history. I watch that with my son, and it gives him a nice introduction to history. And I do great work going through the archives and letting us know all the things that happened on this date.
Oh, thanks. Well, most of the video comes from CBS. And then we would supplement it with others. And I like to say, that will be the singular product of mine that will last for a long time, because we did the day in history that you may read, as it comes across the wire in the old days, now the internet, and 600 shows. So this thing could last a lifetime. and it's a surprise because, it hasn't hit the major networks or even Netflix. It's been picked up by the digital channels, but it'll get there.
We also
are picking up everything, Goodness.
Well, we're big fans here of Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. We hold a little contest every year where listeners vote for our favorite guest. And just a couple of weeks ago, Paula Poundstone won as this year's favorite guest. Paula is a regular on our show, and we've had Tom Baudet on and several of the Wait, Wait participants. It's great to hear a different side of Bill Curtis on there.
Well, I did this one for fun. And the problem with being an anchorman or, a serious news correspondent is you never get to laugh. God forbid a smile, a laugh would enter into that serious news. You say, Charles Manson, well, he finally is going to get his, and he was found guilty. You can't do that. So Wait, Wait, I thought I was just doing a favor for Peter Sagal, a friend of mine. And I wound up liking it so much, and he did. So I'm the straight guy. You need somebody who's over 30. Of course, Paula's over 30. Paula's our star, and these are world-class, stand-up comedy guys. And it's a lot of fun.
And how did you get involved with Will Ferrell and Anchorman?
Adam McKay. Now an Oscar-winning director, this last Sunday he had a full-page picture as an interview. He is hot, hot, hot in the New York Times Magazine. Adam McKay was a senior writer for Saturday Night Live, but back in the day, as they say, he was with Second City here in Chicago when I was on the air as the anchor man and really making my bones. And so I was, I guess, his favorite anchor man. So when this came up, he sent me the script and he said, I know you can't do it or don't want to do it, but, could you keep me, why don't you read it, and et cetera, et cetera. So I'm on the plane and I'm laughing going through the script. And then I send him what turned out to be an audition tape, and not meaning really. And I could hear them at Universal City, and he's there with, you know, literally the handful of guys who were the top comic movie people for the last 10 years or more, laughing. And when you write comedy, once you say it or hear it, it's then old. And so they didn't know what was funny or not. Well, I'm sitting there giving them a big laugh, and they go for it. They loved it, and they said, well, would you like to do this? And I said, let me get back to you. So I called my friend closest, and I said, what about these guys? It's their first movie. You know, you got Will Ferrell and a number that you haven't heard of. And my friend said, no, you know, you never know. You just never know if it's going to be a hit or a miss, but they're good people doing it. So, you know, why not take a chance? So with that advice, I said, okay, I'll do it. It turned out to be the biggest humor movie in the decade following. And I say that because I saw it listed in the top 100 movies by a French source. And Anchorman was the only American film even up there. You know, they have the quirky sense of humor over there. Jerry Lewis is a favorite. And so that's I'm glad I did. Because I said, oh, I'll kill my career. It's a big risk. Every single Anchorman in the country is jealous and wanted to do it. And, you know, there's this myth that said, oh, it was me. It was me. No, in San Diego, I know the guy. Detroit, I know the anchor man that was the model. And we laughed.
Well, we all worked with guys like Ron Burgundy, right?
We did. Oh, we did. Now, it was a good chance to laugh at him.
Now, I have to ask you about this, Bill. Is it true that you and your sister inherited what we know as the Little House on the Prairie?
True, true, true.
Wow.
We have a little replica log cabin of where the Engels lived and a one-room schoolhouse that we moved on. My grandmother, you know, taught there. And a little tiny post office from Wayside, Kansas. We're 14 miles, according to the book, away from Independence. And they went through the records and, you know, put a pin in a map, best estimation, and it landed on my mother's farm. Now, the irony is that the Osage Indians who occupied the reservation at the time were getting ready to be moved off. They knew it. And so old Charlie Ingalls was trespassing, and he thought he'd be there first, and he really just couldn't kill enough game to support the family for a year until the reservation changed. Anyway, they don't appreciate the what they call the racist depiction of the Osage tribe. When they were moved off, they lost a lot in the process. But they landed on a huge piece of land in Oklahoma that just happened to have oil. So they were smart enough to keep the oil rights, sell off the surface, and became the richest per capita people, 2,000 strong in their tribe, in the world. And right now there's a movie being made by Martin Scorsese, and they're shooting at the in Pawhuska, Oklahoma. And back in the 20s, they had so much money, and there with the story about you know, we had a Stetson Bearcat, brand new, and it ran out of gas. And they thought something was wrong with it, so they went and bought another one. and that's how much money they made. Paris Fashion designers open shops in Pawhuska, Oklahoma, so that because that's where the money was. Well, the problem was that they were making so much money, white men would marry one of, well, marry the Indian women, and because they would share the head rights to the monthly payment of oil royalties. And they would marry them after killing the husband. So there were 20 murders associated with the time of the murders. And now they've written a story. They solved the problem, a young guy in the Justice Department. Justice Department didn't even have jurisdiction over the Indian tribe. They thought the reservations were sovereign nations. And then they finally said, okay, the FBI. There wasn't even an FBI. Well, the Justice Department, you go solve it. And a young man named J. Edgar Hoover was assigned, you know, the job of solving, and he used undercover agents for the first time. So it'll be a hell of a movie. But anyway, that's the history. You have a lot of history down there as the frontier moved west.
What a wonderful story.
Out of New England, I should say.
Bill, thank you so much. I've enjoyed your work for many, many years. Appreciate you making time for us today.
Thank you, Rich.